This is a Steam Studio production.
Welcome to the Steam Spotlight, where we celebrate the inspiring achievements of students, educators, and community partners making waves in the Steam field.
For this episode of the Steam Studio Spotlight, we are thrilled to welcome Dr. Pallavi Singh, a molecular microbiologist whose research focuses on the complex world of gut microbes in humans and animals. Dr. Singh's lab studies how these microbial communities interact with their hosts, sometimes helping with growth and development, and other times causing infections. Using advanced DNA sequencing and data analysis tools, her team investigates how harmful bacteria spread and evolve, particularly in ways that impact food safety. A key part of Dr. Singh's work involves tracking how bacteria behave in different environments, whether clinging together in biofilms, swapping genes, or adapting to resist antibiotics. By combining lab experiments with large-scale genetic analysis, Dr. Singh's research helps uncover new ways to combat infections and maintain healthier ecosystems for humans, animals, and environments.
Dr. Singh, welcome to your Steam Studio Spotlight. We are so excited to have you as a guest today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Russ. I'm excited to be here.
Perfect. To all of our listeners who might not know your background, I am incredibly excited, and it's a topic that I never really thought I would be excited for. But before we get into that stuff, can you give us a little bit about your background? How did you get to where you are today? What's your story? And then what are you researching?
Absolutely. So I call myself a molecular microbiologist. What that means is we use molecular tools to study the tiny microbes. And my journey started with my PhD in microbiology, molecular microbiology, studying foodborne pathogens. That means the pathogens like different bacteria that can infect us, but they're transmitted through various food like meat products or produce that can be transmitted. Thereafter, I went on to do a postdoctoral work, which was focused mainly on intestinal microbiome or gut microbiome. That's the most commonly used term. And then when I was looking for, you know, setting up my lab and positions, I came across a position at Northern Illinois University. And so I was able to set up my intestinal microbiome research lab at NIU in the Department of Biological Sciences. And I think our lab actually focuses on group of microbes and the way they help us, but also how important these microbes, specifically bacteria, are in terms of causing various infections. And when we talk about improving human health, we have to take into consideration how we are interlinked with other groups like animals, plants, soil, environment. And so this intersection and the interconnectedness of the different, you know, species around us and how they influence us and how we influence them is really important to understand. And microbes, you may or may not know, can jump from one group of species to another. They can jump from soil to water, water to animals, animals to humans, and back in the, this environment. And so our research lab is actually focused on this term called One Health Initiative, which essentially means that the health of the environment, plants, animals, and humans are all important for improvement of overall health. And so we study that interconnectedness. And that interconnectedness could not be done without collaboration and transdisciplinary research. And so I rely a ton on various experts within our university, across universities, even across countries. So that's what we do in a nutshell.
What was the term you said, the one, what was that? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, it's called One Health Initiative.
Wow. And so looking at everything as a whole, which seems relatively simple, like seems like, oh yeah, that's how we should do it. But is that relatively new or innovative? Is that not the traditional approach then?
Usually, you know, when we say we are experts of something, a human expert, you know, would be focused on improving human health. We can give them, for example, physicians, if you go in with certain symptoms, they will just ask about you. What did you eat? Where did you travel? What are your symptoms? What are you allergic to? And then probably prescribe you medicines accordingly, right? And so researchers are also focused that way. Some researchers are very specific. However, it's been realized that we cannot improve the health of one species while ignoring what's going on around us.
Wow.
I'll give you a simple example. And I hope it's simple. you know, we have, we are experiencing climate change effects. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. With the change in temperature, we've all heard there's rise in sea level, et cetera, right? But with this rise in temperature, what also gets affected are the tiny microbes that live within the water, that live within the soil. And how they're affected is because they are used to a certain temperature. Mm-hmm. Like how we are used to. I am very particular. I like it between 65 and 72 Fahrenheit. That's my happy zone.
Yes.
Microbes have happy zones of themselves as well, that they can grow and reproduce and do whatever they need to do in the environment. And most of them have quite beneficial effects.
Okay.
But with the changes, they have to adapt as well. For example, if it gets quite hot and if they do not have mechanisms to protect themselves, they'll probably die off. Or if it rains too hard and it floods, that affects their house itself, right? So they would get washed up. And I bring you back to these microbes because on a bigger scale, people can see macroscopically what's happening. But again, my lab is, and I'm a microbiologist, so I keep taking people back to the microscopic level. And how the, you know, effect of these simple things that we're experiencing, not so simple, but things that we're experiencing affect the tiniest little things, and then it goes back to us. And so if we do not study the factors that are causing these changes, how do we study the changes that are affecting these microbes? Because we know that these microbes are important for our health. They're important for human, animal health, soil health, plant health, everything.
I don't think about the microscopic part of our world at all. Like it goes back to that thinking of, well, out of sight, out of mind. If I don't see it, I don't think about it. And especially when it takes equipment to even know it exists, it's very easy to ignore that. But you're positing that that's where a lot of changes are coming and we should be paying attention to that.
I think microbes are brilliant and they are so important and they contribute significantly to every environment they live in. And even if we don't see them, they're all around us. They're in the room that we're sitting in, the air that we're breathing, on our skin, hair, on the bike, everything, right? And they're doing something while they're there. And so I think that the importance of the microbes is not only from their actions, but also that they are the common link. Like they can get transmitted. They move around from one ecosystem to another. And when I say ecosystem, we talk about animals, humans, plants again. So that circle. And so when we talk about, you know, certain changes and researching certain factors, how do these microbes get affected and how do they get spread in the environment to affect different species?
Wow. You used a, you said microbes are brilliant. Is there an example of that sound? That sounded like really personal. Do you have like a microbe that's your favorite or some example that you're like, this was really interesting to see? And I might be putting you on the spot, so I apologize.
No, that's okay. I was talking about pathogens that can cause infections. Mm-hmm. And so when they are able to cause infections, right, first they have to actually find a stronghold. What that means is if we take them in, our body has a lot of defense mechanisms to get rid of them. So they have to fight at least three layers of defense mechanisms to survive and then form a stronghold and use the nutrition that is for us towards their benefit. Wow. And so for each of these steps, from them entering our body to them proliferating and growing their own kind, there are specific mechanisms that are present that allow them to do that. And that's why I call them brilliant, because if we take specific examples, one of the bugs that we work on is called Shiga toxin producing E. coli.
Okay.
A lot of people would have heard the word E. coli or Escherichia coli. It's a common microbe found in fecal or, you know, stool samples. It's present in our gut. Mostly, it does not cause any infection. However, certain group of bacteria were able to evolve and become, one group became Shiga toxin producing E. coli, also called as STEC.
Okay.
As you look at the name, Shiga toxin, it produces some sort of a toxin.
Mm-hmm.
And that toxin can actually infect our kidneys and cause kidney damage. In severe cases, it can be fatal to humans. But it is a gut bacteria. So in early instances of the infection, some people might just experience diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
As it elevates, there can be blood in the poop. Mm-hmm. And in severe cases, kidney can be damaged. So if you think about this bacteria, a tiny bacteria, it has to go through all of the layers of protection, form a stronghold, and then produce toxin that can travel from our intestines to our kidney and cause kidney damage. And there are specific mechanisms, and I don't want to bore people with the mechanisms, but that's why I call them brilliant, right? And when we talk about these things, like, for example, when I mentioned climate change and now the bacteria would need to think about how do I survive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So either they'll get wiped out, but if they're important for certain functions, they would need to find strategies to survive. We know that in the environment, the bacteria, one way to evolve is to acquire genes from other species.
Okay.
So other species of bacteria. So similarly for Shiga toxin producing E. coli, the toxin, which is called Shiga-like, mm-hmm. is from another bacteria, Shigella. And so Shigella is a different pathogen that can cause infection, but that's where it got its name from.
I see.
And the way it gets transferred is, or acquired, is through tiny viruses that are specific to bacteria. Can you imagine? There are viruses that can actually target the tiny bacteria.
And do they then like infect them, or like they try it? Because now I'm thinking like they're the same size, or right? Like, I mean, it's all micro at that point.
Yeah. So they're all microbes, but there are various sizes of microbes.
Duh. Okay. Just like our world. Okay. Okay.
Right. So viruses are much smaller than bacteria.
I see.
And then the viruses that infect bacteria are much smaller than some of the viruses that we may encounter as well.
Okay.
And these I call them viruses, but they're actually called as bacteriophage or bacteriophage.
I see.
And these bacteriophages, they infect bacteria, and the infection is essentially killing of the bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to how they infect our cells once one virus injects its genetic material, it can take over our machinery, produce, you know, hundreds of its virions. Similarly, bacteriophages can do that. However, in certain cases, they get integrated into the genome of the bacteria. And so that integration also provides this additional benefit.
Ability? Yeah, benefit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
So the sugar toxin actually is carried by a bacteriophage on the bacteria estec. And that's how it links the whole picture together.
Wow. Dr. Singh, I'm going to put this out. Infections are bad. I don't want anyone to get an infection. I don't want to. But, however, from a purely scholarly or academic perspective, infections can be beautiful. Like what they had, the enduring, how they live and how they survive on that one, that I never looked at it in any way other than I don't want to get sick. You know, like that right. There's no benefit to them. I'm just like, we need to get rid of them always. And I know I'm ignorant to a lot of those things, but I hadn't really thought of what it takes for an infection to do it. And then on the other side, how we combat them, like as humans without even outside interventions, just being able to say, no, I have defense mechanism for them. I don't always think about that until something doesn't work. And then I'm like, help me, please.
Right. Exactly. Because your body just takes on it, identifies something foreign and kicks in to gear and like, okay, let's get rid of it. But I'm so glad I could excite you about microbiology and the importance of the tiny microbes.
Dr. Singh, there is a biology teacher in high school when Russ was significantly younger, sitting there being like, why couldn't you ask these questions then, Russ? You would have learned a whole lot more. So thank you for helping with that. So then as you're looking at these things, you're talking about stool and fecal matter. Like it sounds like a lot of times your research comes with poop, like for a very raw term. Is that true? Like, is that really where a lot of your research ends up?
Absolutely. I think I should call my lab House of Poop. we have freezers full of fecal sample from various studies that we are doing. And the reason for that is it's a non-invasive way of studying what we want to study. So when we collect fecal samples from various animals, we are actually looking at the microbes that are present in the fecal sample. So as the food gets digested in our intestinal system, it passes. And as it's passing, the digested matter is passing, so are the bacteria that are residing pass along with the digested material. And that's what ends up in the poop. So when we collect these poops, our goal is to look at the community of bacteria that are present in these samples. Does that make sense?
It does. It completely. Okay. So what do you do? So you're looking at a community. Are you looking at how they're interacting within that environment, this one poop sample? And then do you try and extrapolate that out to a larger and like to our human lived environment, or what's then that like next step?
Absolutely. So we have various projects. So one of the projects I'll talk to you about is looking at intestinal microbiome of bison. And bison are beautiful animals, as you know.
They're
majestic.
Huge. They're
huge.
Very large people or animals, which probably produce very large Poops.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is good for us. The more, the better, right?
Oh, great. Okay. So good job, Bison, for helping science.
Exactly. Difficulty comes when we work with tiny rodents and then we have to wait and sit and hope that they'll give us at least 2 pellets that we can actually study.
You have to
have
enough. I never thought... Oh, Dr. Singh, when you started out, did you ever be like, I need a certain amount of poop before I can do my work? Like, that was...
No, and honestly, even the students, the undergraduate students and the graduate students who are involved, they were like, we would have never thought that we would be actually cheering for these animals to poop and be like, yay, poop.
So
we all do that because then that helps us move forward and be done with the day. Yes. So I was talking about bison and large amount of poop that we can get from them. The goal of studying bison for our lab, again, comes from the One Health perspective.
Mm-hmm.
One, that they are keystone species. That means they affect the environment quite a bit. So as we know that Illinois has tall grass prairie lands. Of course, they have gone down significantly in percentage, like less than 0.1% remains in the whole of United States. But there have been efforts to restore these prairie lands.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the restoration efforts was also introducing bison to these grasslands.
Okay.
And the reason for this is that bison are also like ecosystem engineer, because as they are walking, they are trampling through different shrubs and the grasslands that's present there. They're chomping on food, so they're kind of these grassland mowers, right?
Yes.
And as they're walking, they're also disturbing the soil and transferring the microbes within.
Okay.
And as they're consuming food, they're also defecating and urinating and salivating. And so they're introducing microbes from their mouth, from urine, from fecal into the soil.
Okay.
So if you think about it, they're also doing a job of manuring by providing fertilizers to the soil, which enhances growth of the grassland. So just one perspective. So to tell you that these animals help in the growth of grassland. So we are interested in looking at what factors drive the health of these animals. The way to do that is to study the gut microbiome, because we know that there's a link between a diverse and healthy gut and the microbes within it towards the benefit of the animal overall.
Okay.
And that's true for humans as well. Microbes in our gut produce different kinds of metabolites. Some of them are called like short-chain fatty acids, which are beneficial for our health. They produce a lot of other functions. For example, there's a direct link between training our immune system, and that happens to the microbes. There's a link between our gut and our brain, and it's called a gut-brain axis. And so the microbes in our gut influence how we feel, can influence how we feel, and vice versa. It's a bidirectional communication that takes place. So they're important for overall health of the animal as well as us. And so that's one of the reasons that we're looking at the microbes that are present in these animals. So the next step is to see how these microbes change. Is there a seasonal effect on the microbes of the that are found in the gut of these animals? The other perspective, and I say One Health, is also we know that these animals are being raised for meat product as well. I don't know if you've seen bison jerkies around.
A couple of times, and I'm like, I'm not sure if I'm interested in that.
Well, the reason it's gaining popularity is because it's rich in protein and less in fat content as compared to beef products.
Okay.
And so there are farmers. They're usually there are big and small farmers across Illinois that are doing this, are raising bison for meat and so on and so forth. And so when we look at these microbes and the farmers, not the farmers, the ranchers? Animals in the farmland. We are trying to understand what drives this community of microbes, but also in terms of if there are certain microbes that may be found in these animals. Again, estec, for example, if they are found in these animals at different ranches, they can be transmitted to humans. And so the microbes that we study, we want to look at the association of how they can influence colonization by these pathogens that can be transmitted from animals to humans. So there's a farm-to-fork model of looking at various foodborne pathogens, and one of the factors that can influence the colonization of pathogens in animals could be the microbial composition in the gut as well. So those are the different perspectives of looking at the gut microbiome of bison.
I guess when you say all of that incredible information, I didn't give the due credit to bison in my life, I guess is kind of what I'm saying. As you've done research and you're looking at different animals and different environments, do you end up finding that perspective in each animal or each, I don't know, even bacteria? You're like, oh, every one of these things is essential? Or have you come across something that is completely not useful in our world and we should just, you know, like, let's stop exerting the energy on it? I'm thinking specifically of snakes because I'm afraid of them. Okay.
I have not worked with snakes.
Good. That's a great decision for you.
And it could be my fear, but I'm afraid of various animals. So I do wait for the animals to move away before we can collect fecal samples. Students are more brave than I am, actually. So I let them do the field study.
I think you're more wise than they are. That's what it's coming out. Bravery and wisdom.
I could say that next time. Yes. But I'm very open and I say, I'm afraid, so you go do it.
yes. But most of those different species or whatever form they may take, they're pretty much all essential is what I'm kind of taking away from it.
So, again, they contribute to various different functions. Do we know all the functions that these microbes carry out? Not really. But we know that if we have a diverse group of microbes, it is overall better for the health of the host. And I say host now because that's true for humans and animals. Mm-hmm. There are certain larger group of microbes such as the Firmicutes and Bacteroidetes that have been shown to be good for health and, again, for the host. But that's the larger group, and there are several family species within these groups. And again, we probably do not know the function of all of these microbes that are present. However, if they don't have these pathogenic genes, those are what we are focusing on, right? Like if we are harboring pathogens, which when we talk about these animals, when I say transferring from a farm to fork model, it's because these animals usually do not exhibit any symptoms. So they're like asymptomatic carriers of these pathogens, which are pathogens for humans, but not really for the animals.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, if they're part of the animal, that's not beneficial to them, but that doesn't really harm them either, right? And so we are studying it because it harms humans.
I see. Wow. This has just been completely educational, of course, as you are. as you're doing your work and you're at this point, is there something you'd really like more people to know about from just the everyday person? If instead of having to listen to a whole episode or go to one of your awesome lectures or have the ability to go study bison poop with you, regardless of how brave you are, is there something that like the person on the street could take away and say, that is important and I wish everyone would know?
One of the factors that we are studying is called antimicrobial resistance.
Okay.
And which essentially means that the antibiotics that are being used for treatment of infections are not working as they should be. And so we are becoming resistant to them. And when we say we are becoming resistant, that essentially means if you get infected by clinical infection, by a bacteria, the bacteria becomes resistant. And so we cannot clear out the bacteria from our system, and thereby they don't they carry on to damage us.
I see.
So, and the reason I bring up this new word here is because that's the rising threat. Actually, not the rising, it is the current threat. Climate change and antimicrobial resistance are the two main threats that our current environment is facing. And so one of the reasons for rise in antimicrobial resistance or resistance to antibiotics is usage of or misusage or misadministration of antibiotics. For example, if you have a flu, right, that's caused by a virus, and you end up taking antibiotics, it has no effect on the virus.
I see.
Right? Because the antibiotics are designed to kill bacteria.
Bacteria,
if you
yes.
do not have a bacterial infection, it will do nothing for your virus. However, what it will do is wipe out your gut microbiome. Because all of the bacteria in the gut that are actually helping you to, you know, fight the infection, produce the nutrition that you need, they get wiped out.
Wow.
That's one human health. Now, I'll put that in one health perspective. Mm-hmm. Now, as you're taking this antibiotic, which was not required in the first place, you're also defecating, and then it goes into the wastewater system, the sewage wastewater system. Majority of the antibiotic that we take gets released out through stools or urine.
Even if it's necessary.
Yes,
that's how we get rid of it through
the
our system.
Body gets rid of the toxin. It's, it's a foreign compound. It gets rid of it.
Okay.
And now all of this antibiotic, whether it was useful or not, gets released into the environment. And as it's getting released, there are other microbes in the environment that are now trying to survive in the presence of this antibiotics. And so they are gaining resistance as well. So we are looking at, actually, one of the projects, we're looking at wastewater systems and our river systems and looking for antimicrobial resistant genes and bacteria. And again, human perspective is one. The second major reason we are in this problem is because of usage of antibiotics in animals, animal facilities. And so the same thing happens. The animals take it, they defecate, it releases into the environment, into the soil, rainwater, spreads it. And so the microbes that are now trying to survive in this changed environment are gaining these resistant genes. So not all of them are pathogenic, not all of them cause infections. However, if there are ones that do cause infections, they can also gain these genes. And if they infect us, and that can happen through consuming meat products, that can happen through consuming produce, because they can be used as fertilizers, manure, or just a simple rain can do that, transmit. And if you end up with that infection and you go to the hospital, well, now you have a resistant bug, a super bug that they call, right? And you can't clear it out. So The one thing that you actually asked, I'm sorry I had to give this big story behind
it. No, it was all very informative.
is actually being careful about using antibiotics in your daily life. We all have to do our part in the environment. We all have to contribute towards safety of humans, animals, plants, everything. And of course, there are people who can play major roles, but what can you do at your end? Don't use somebody else's prescription. Just stop your antibiotic in between, like complete your dose. Don't flush out the antibiotics. Have proper disposal. So those are some of the things I would say that we can do at our end to help.
Dr. Singh, that was, so I've heard that, you know, you're kind of, you hear that like, oh, we've over prescribed antibiotics. And I think that's spread around enough, but I hadn't known all of those steps that, oh no, it's not just you. It's where it goes afterwards. And then it's where it goes after that. And then it's where, and you, unless you take the time to really fully understand that cycle, it amplifies the problem in my mind. So I'm very grateful for that. Also, I might have, bad dreams because of it, but that's okay. I'm joking, but those are things that we need to think about. And I wish sometimes my resort is just to put your head in the sand and not look at it, but then the problem doesn't go away. And having people like you talk about it is helpful because, again, each of us can have that role in our own lives and our own decisions for that.
Absolutely.
Dr. Singh, I am incredibly grateful for your time and your wisdom and your knowledge. I know the work you're doing is incredibly important, even if most people like myself don't see it. I am grateful for you. And again, thank you just for being here and sharing your thoughts.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on here. It was great sharing all this with you. And I hope it's informative for everyone who'd listen in.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a production of the STEAM Studio. Please make sure you like, subscribe, and leave a review to help others discover our shows. You can listen on platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to this STEAM Spotlight. Thank you to our partners, NIU STEAM and Northern Illinois University, for supporting this podcast. If you would like to learn more about the work we do, please check us out online at niusteam.niu.edu. Thank you so much for listening.